Good afternoon. My name is Rochelle, and I'm also glad to be here. This is an incredible panel, and we are in an incredible time in terms of human trafficking policy and programming. So I have no disclosures. I'm going to talk first a little bit about what the federal government is doing in terms of human trafficking. As you know, law enforcement has been a large part of our work and continues to be. We partner with Homeland Security, Justice, Department of Labor, other departments as well. This slide shows different sections of work at the federal level. There's law enforcement in the blue, there's victim services in the green. At the bottom, there's research, training, awareness, outreach, and diplomacy. HHS, Health and Human Services, where I work, is in the green area, as well as at the bottom, the research, training, and awareness. So there's a lot of people in the federal government working on human trafficking, and for the first time, we're working together. So earlier, Kimberly mentioned this Federal Strategic Action Plan. I have a couple of copies that I brought with me. That link will get you directly to the plan. The plan is wonderful. The plan tells government to work well together. And so we have over 270 actions. The department I work in has over 80 actions specifically. And this plan goes until 2017. And so this gives accountability to the public. So you can watch what our progress is from 2013 to 2017. Within HHS, we have central office staff like myself, people from D.C., but we also have an incredible network of regional staff, and I think I have a couple of them in the audience maybe. Mary Wynn, raise your hand there. She's your Region 5 human trafficking liaison, so she covers Chicago and the states around Chicago. And Marlene, are you here? Okay, Region 4, so that's the Southeast, Florida, Mississippi. And so we have 10 regions in HHS, and we have a monthly call with our human trafficking liaisons, and they tell us all the wonderful things they're doing in their states in terms of program and policy. So the goal and the specific action I want to focus my time is on support, outreach, and training efforts to engage medical first responder personnel and hospital staff. I do need to tell you that in June we created an office on trafficking in persons, and I'm serving as the acting deputy director of that new office. For the first time last year, we put dollars and much effort into domestic human trafficking. So that's U.S. slaves, okay? For the past 15 years, we've been working on foreign nationals, so people who come from other countries to the United States. And we have services for foreign nationals. They're treated like refugees. So they get medical services, they get some help with job training. So now we have one office, we have the international side by side with the domestic, and I think you can imagine how wonderful that is. These are our priority areas. We're gonna do things around prevention. Data, you heard a couple of people say our numbers are really bad, they are really bad. We're working toward a national count. Now, domestic violence took several years to come up with a wonderful count of domestic violence in the country. It's going to take us several years as well. And our topic is, I think, tougher than domestic violence. We are about 25 years behind domestic violence, but they are working side by side because human trafficking is just part of a whole continuum of violence. So we love our partners in domestic violence, and we have a big, bold goal of working on a national count. We have one data person in our office. We stole her from HRSA, and her job is to march us toward a count. So we won't say in the future there are between 100,000 and 300,000 victims in the United States. We can get a little bit more specific. That would be beautiful. Okay, so what is SOAR? You've heard it mentioned a couple of times. So SOAR is a training that we created last year. We piloted it. These are the learning objectives that you see on the screen. Each of these is S-O-A-R. So number one is S and number four is R. Stop, observe, ask and respond. And so we've had a technical working group, and some of the members of the panel were on a technical working group made up of survivors, healthcare providers, and experts in human trafficking. We did this training, A, because it's an action in our plan, but also because we wanted to reach the healthcare providers and tell them who's in your waiting room, and tell them you are the people who can really, who the victim or survivor would be right in front of often. So here it is again, stop, observe, ask, respond. Labor trafficking is as important as sex trafficking. You haven't heard a lot of it mentioned here, but this slide, I'm showing you some slides from our SOAR training. Can't show you the whole thing because, as you heard, it's 2 hours long. But I wanted to show you, this is one of my favorite, because when I think about trafficking, I think about it not just in a healthcare setting. I think about it when I go to the grocery store, for example, who's that little boy selling candy? And who's that guy next to him? Is that really somebody from his school? Or when I, that's panhandling sites, construction sites. That's, when I hear about a casino going up, really quick, I wonder who are the workers in that casino? And I don't have time to go through all of these, but our colleagues in the Department of Labor would be on me, like white on rice, to say, Rochelle, talk about labor trafficking side by side as you talk about sex trafficking. So here's a slide about sex trafficking and some of the places that sex trafficking occurs. High-risk domestic populations. The numbers really matter, and you need to know who are the people who are most at risk. You heard that those people who are in systems are at great risk, so foster children, people involved in criminal justice. I'm going to add a bullet here of people with disabilities, and that's very important, and we're going to be engaging with the APHA disability section on these domestic populations. So runaway homeless youth, LGBTQ, racial and ethnic minorities. One of my hopes is that we talk more about racial ethnic minorities in the domain of human trafficking. This is a slide I created from a Department of Justice document. And it is of the sex trafficking victims whose race was known, I wanted to show that sex trafficking by race, 40% African American, 24% Hispanic, 25% white, 4% Asian, and about 6% other. That's Native Americans and others not identified. That's sex trafficking. On the other side is labor trafficking. As you would expect, a high number of Hispanics, 56%, 9% black, Asian, 14%. This is important. We have to talk about race because as we try to move toward more public awareness, there's all kind of opportunities, even within APHA, with the Latino caucus, the Black Workers Caucus. There's just so many people who we could be working with. I'll move more quickly. This is the study out in New York, Covenant House. It's important to know that most of the traffickers are known to the person. Only 9% are strangers. So that whole stranger danger, it's really the families and the friends that you need to be watching. You've heard a little bit about contact with healthcare professionals and emergency doctors and dentists in particular, and primary care docs are often seeing victims of human trafficking. Barriers to identify patients. On one side you see providers, the other side you see patients. What are the indicators of trafficking in the healthcare setting? Some things to look for, broken teeth, unusual tattoos, eye injuries, scars from cigarettes. This is tough stuff to work on. Referral network. Okay, so there's a victim surrounded by a bunch of folks who hopefully will be helping him or her get out of the life and then get a life. So we want to identify champions. As we're talking about protocols, in order for there to be a protocol anywhere, you heard how much work that takes, you need a champion. So it doesn't have to be the person making the most money. It needs to be somebody who has some clout in that healthcare system. Protocol development, there are some different steps that you need to go through. A big one is separation procedure. And in our training, we talk about how to separate from the trafficker from the victim. Here are some federal resources. I have some things in the back of the room as well. Blue Campaign was here, I think yesterday, at the film festival. So they've been around for 5 years working on human trafficking, and they are out of the Department of Homeland Security. So we work closely with the Blue Campaign on anti-trafficking messaging. National Human Trafficking Resource Center is we fund this. We've been funding it since 2007. So there's one hotline. If you could write that number down, just think about it, 888-373-7888. There are other hotlines that are survivor-led and other-led, but this is the national one that's funded by the federal government. So let's talk about SWORD pilot training results. We trained in 6 different cities, and we trained not just healthcare professionals, but you can see social service providers we also had in the mix. We trained about 180 people, and we had the pre-post and 3-month email and 3-month phone call, all using OMB-approved tools. That kind of makes us different, that we were able to evaluate this small pilot as we went along. We did see some attitude change. We saw some statistically significant change in between the pre-post test. Folks said they learned something, which is always good. So our next steps, I'm just moving a little really quickly here. We need to implement SOAR on a much higher and more organized level. These are some of the recommendations that came out of the SOAR training from 2014. They said, first, broaden your site. We went to 6 cities. We worked with, for example, in Boston, Mass General Hospital, in Oakland, Alameda County. Down in Atlanta, we worked with the dentist, the Greater Dental Society of Atlanta. They said, get bigger. Then they said, modify the length. We're not just going to be stuck with 2 hours. We're going to do the short version, which our doctors that do it grand rounds-wise, and we are going to do the long version as well. Expand the content. So we had experts in HHS that talk about, from Office of Minority Health and others that talk about the class standards, cultural linguistic standards, and also trauma-informed. We put some of that in. One of our regions took our SOAR training and then did more trainings in the interim for their states and territories. So for U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, trainings have happened in at least all parts of Region 2. Then they said put it online. So there's some great models out there for training online, and we've been looking at them and learning from them. And we will have CEU credits, and there's 7 categories of folks who will get that CE credit. This is important, so I need to look at my notes. So the 7 categories are the dentists, the doctors, the nurses, the PAs, physician assistants, mental health, substance abuse, and public health, because we know public health has not been very active yet in this. So CEU credits will be offered. And then incorporate survivors of human trafficking. So we were fortunate in the first year. We had survivors working with us. They were just on the technical working group. Feedback last call, some of y'all remember, was, well, that was nice, but we should be out there training, and you should be paying us too, as just like you're getting paid. So we've learned those lessons. We have dollars for that. Our big partner with this, as you heard, is the Office on Women's Health. I want to correct somebody who said it was just them. No, they got us started. By getting their $300,000 for SOAR the first year, we were able to go to ACF and get $300,000, and we have that match for the next 3 years. So sometimes that's how it works in government. Somebody put some big money out there. Can you imagine somebody else putting something out on something you're supposed to be doing? Okay, so that's kind of how it works, and now we have many parts of HHS putting their activities in. The last bullet here is coordinating a new public awareness campaign. Our campaign 15 years ago was Look Beneath the Surface. And we've had that video up there, and we've had all those materials, some of them in the back of the room. We're going to change all that. That was created when we were only doing foreign nationals. We're doing domestic and foreign nationals. So we're going to create a brand new video, and we're going to have new materials, and we're going to have survivors and providers in that video, not people like me who have flags behind them. So I'm going to stop right there, but this has been great. Thank you.
And there's her contact information. Thank you so much to all of our presenters. I hope for those of you who are in the audience, whether you're new to the topic of trafficking or not, that you've heard today that trafficking is a health issue. And you've heard from really the experts, the movers and the shakers in the field on innovative practices in medical education, as well as protocol development and pushing the policy envelope forward. We have a couple of minutes for questions. We have 15 minutes for questions. Fantastic. In terms of structuring this, if you have specific questions for individual panelists, please direct them directly towards them and introduce yourself as well, very briefly. I don't want a monologue before the question, but just so that we know where the question is coming from so we can contextualize it, and I'll just call on people by show of hands. So,
I'm Kirsten Thompson. I'm a physician assistant educator. I live in the state of Maine, and our governor is having a governor's summit on November 11th and 12th, and I can share it with you, on human sexual trafficking, because in the state of Maine, we're recognizing that there are quite a few young people.
So on November 12th in the state of Maine, there will be a summit on sex trafficking specifically. Thank you for sharing that.
Hi, my name is Samantha. I'm a student in research in Philadelphia. I was wondering if there were any initiatives to integrate human trafficking care into medical school curriculum programs.
I'm just going to repeat the questions as they come. So the question for our panelists is, are there any initiatives underway to integrate human trafficking training into medical education at the school level?
To the best of my knowledge, there's four right now. There are a few under development. The Kansas State University has one, and which is multidisciplinary on human trafficking. Dr. Mary Deschenay is developing one at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. I believe Johns Hopkins has one, and there's a fourth that I'm losing. And that's why a lot of researchers and people that are involved in this issue are advocating, which is part of our policy and position statement, and Dr. Stefalosa can speak more to that, is the request for integrating more into med school, advanced practice, PA school, first responder training for understanding and recognizing
the trafficking.
Does anyone? Excuse me, I want to say that the University of Toledo has a certificate on human trafficking.
A certificate for the hospital. That's good. I wasn't aware of that.
And Dr. Sylvia Williams is the director of the human trafficking department.
So University of Toledo as well. Is it in addition to that comment, or is it?
So I think my background is the same initiative that we like to mention for youth, like high school or high school students. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. So I'll table that for just a second. I just wanted to close out on the medical education piece. This is one of the roles that we see the HEAL network playing, is really pushing that internal advocacy within our healthcare professional settings forward. And so one piece of that is passing policy statements on the medical association side of things, including APHA, but a number of medical associations have passed policies, and then working on the grassroots level with nursing schools, medical schools. And it's really exciting. We're seeing more and more of these programs rising up at the education level for the initial education of our healthcare providers. And some states are starting to legislate it as a piece of all of our clinicians need to have, in order to be licensed, need to have a training on human trafficking. So there are both kind of these ad hoc as well as kind of more systematic efforts that are underway in the country. So I'm going to ask the panelists your question. So the question was around efforts for prevention.
We at our health center, we have a youth program curriculum as well as a youth development organization spin-off specifically for subjects with minors and called Life is Play. And if you contact me, I can help you with that.
And there's another initiative. A lot of the homeless networks and homeless advisory committees and commissions are recognizing that being homeless, it makes one particularly vulnerable to traffickers. So a lot of homeless organizations are starting to incorporate the study of and the intersection of the two. So that's the best that I can speak to that. And I do know that school nurses are becoming more aware and more involved because of the recruitment efforts that are going on within the junior high and high school. So it's coming, but again, a highlight of the infancy. And we've all talked about we truly are in the infancy of where we're going.
And so, piggybacking on that, I took the SOAR train down to Region 4 in January, and it went to Cat County. Just don't you know, SOAR is plug and play. So I took out all the medical stuff, created the slide about education, and tools that the Department of Education has, and we trained school counselors, school nurses, et cetera. HHS is all about prevention as well, so we're involving CDC and Department of Health and People 2020. So there's a lot that we do with
This is also feedback on answering that. There are a lot of initiatives that are specifically looking at prevention and vaccination from a variety of angles. Many of them are local, some of them are looking at actually talking to perpetrators who've been caught. And a lot of these initiatives are sort of, like I said, local grown, but I think it's important for us to recognize as well that it's not just targeting children and foreign nationals, but looking at considering the risk factors for trafficking, right? So a lot of organizations have already existed before trafficking became a topic of our national conversation, the Boys and Girls Club, that provide mentorships to youth so that we're addressing some of those risk factors, like someone in agreement with someone carrying your life itself. Those kind of things. Those are trafficking prevention efforts as well. These might be branded.
And there are a number of people that are working, a number of organizations working in the educational space. The Nest Foundation, A21 is working on some. So there's a number of kind of somewhat geographically based, but also national efforts that are looking at the school age population. So. So the first piece was directed to Dr. Nellum in terms of that shift towards the domestic trafficking, and then a question about specifically about the sample composition and what component were domestic versus foreign national.
So that's a great question, and actually I didn't talk about it very much in my slides. We were mostly focusing on foreign-born individuals in this particular study. I would say that in the UK, the attention towards minors who are trafficked is certainly inclusive of domestic as well as foreign-born individuals. But in terms of the majority of the research I'm aware of that's going on right now, it's predominantly focused on foreign-born individuals who've been trafficked from outside the UK into the UK. And my slide didn't show the demographic characteristics in relation to ethnicity your country of origin, even though I've talked about some of the age and all that, I think that's an important thing, an oversight perhaps. A lot of the individuals we included came from Eastern Europe, and as you know, we're within the EU, and so there's a free movement of persons between the EU and the UK, and there's a lot of individuals who have been trafficked as a result of that, because it's not as complicated to get them into the EU. But we also see a lot of populations from other countries, including Brazil, Nigeria, and I think the demographics are fairly similar to those that you see in the UK in terms of countries of origin, just because those are the countries where perhaps there are the greatest number of risk factors that contribute to men and women being trafficked. I'm saying push-pull factors, I suppose. But I think it's important not to forget about domestic trafficking, whether you're talking about minors or adults. So thank you for bringing that up.
And then the second part of that question was, I think it was actually a reflection on Dr. Rollins' comments about this shift of thinking just primarily about trafficking as an issue of foreign nationals to looking within our own borders.
Okay, so folks, I didn't say shift. If I warned you, I didn't say shift. What I want is to, think about the money. There's a limited amount of money. But we took more money into things in 2014. We're not shifting away from foreign nationals. Stack of foreign nationals who are waiting for certified certification and kids eligibility letters, all that's still going on. It's just moved from the Office of Refugee Resettlement into this one combined office. The dollars were not touched for foreign nationals. It's just that dollars have jumped for domestic trafficking. The law has jumped. There's more laws in this country now around trafficking. So I look at it as a wake-up call. That's what's happening here. And we all are messengers to wake up other more folks. But the shifting, no.
That's what sort of really is that. It's kind of a combination of our two countries. But I think another thing that's important to remember when we're talking about where does the focus lie is that whilst we do think about women coming from countries that perhaps have greater pull factors or socioeconomic factors, just making women at greater, men and women at greater risk of being trafficked. Everyone's at risk. You're at risk, and I'm at risk. And one of the women I worked with as part of the study, and I don't want to say too much about her for confidentiality reasons, but she was from the United States, and she was my age, and she was highly educated to my level. She was a doctor, actually, MD, and she was trafficked to the UK. So I think it's important not to forget that you don't just have to be poor or mentally ill or have been abused.
I only have time for two more questions. I'm going to all the way on the left in the back there. You? Yes.
Diane Young from Law for Now, Medical College of New York State. I wanted to ask anyone on the panel, to what extent is the HPV vaccine being offered to young people? I didn't hear
certainly that's a cornerstone of primary care, so absolutely.
And I think that Dr. Jordan Greenbaum is a trailblazer, and you've probably heard of her, and she refers to that as anticipatory guidance and advocating for those would-be, and Dr. Stoplosa, and you can, and Dr. McKinney, Susan Stryker can speak more to that as far as what different protocols are doing as far as offering that,
you
know. Well, go ahead. It's basically one of the recommended immunizations, so absolutely it's recommended in primary care. So with minors, you get into a little bit of issues where we can see patients for reproductive health issues, but immunization is being parental or guardian consent. So, you know, the workaround is really getting these kids into primary care. and working with whoever their guardians may be.
I saw something very interesting. I don't know if you all saw this, but it has never even crossed my radar. 20 years in the emergency room, right? And it has never, and traffic, working with trafficking victims for 15, it's never crossed my mind for that vaccine for men and boys. And then I saw a poster presentation on it a couple of days ago, and it was like a light bulb went off. And it was like, why wasn't I thinking of this?
So it's definitely an important part of when we're able to link them with primary care. It needs to definitely be there as part of standard of care. And I think you had your hand up the longest, so you're going to be my last question. And for those of you who weren't able to ask your questions, please feel free to come up afterwards.
Just real quick, could you just tell us from Cal State Fullerton, California, I'm a first-year master student, and I'm kind of new to this field, but
So kind of a two-part question. One being, how do you deal with your own perception of your personal safety? And then secondly, the attitudes in culture that drive trafficking.
I wasn't scared when you said that. The only time I was scared, I had to do my own research. I went to my church at night because my pastor said that it's temp control. It's the oldest church, black church in D.C. And so I went with them 4 o'clock in the morning and I watched. And I got mad. And we went inside to preach at 8 o'clock. Women were still out there all around the church. And then the temp were right there next to my car. And so that's when I got scared. So that was like, I'm not going to be by myself. You know, I could be gone in a second if anybody could be snatched and had taken into the life. But you had a great slide. Somebody had a great slide about the safety of the virus. That's real important. In our training, who do you go if you have to have a security system? There no. You have to have a safe place for the victim. But on a personal level, I'm not really thinking about that coming after Michelle. I can't think like that.
And I can talk about that. What, in some of my on-field research that I do, I ride with the gang units in D.C. and in San Antonio and Dallas and Corpus Christi. So I do a lot of gang work, and I go in disguise. I don't dress like I normally dress, and I wear a wig and baseball cap because I am on the ground and I'm like within this two biggest gang bangers and MS-13ers in South Texas that I do disguise, and I don't use my real name if I do things within the community. Nationally, it doesn't worry me, but my own, the cartels and the gangs in my own community, since I'm so involved on the ground, that yes, that does worry me. So I change my hair. My hair is everything wrong. I couldn't get it all up.
Just for providers in the room, it's something to think about when you're seeing patients personally. But if you weren't in the ED, it's probably something to think about all the time anyway. Sometimes patients or kids who aren't so kosher. But it is, like Dr. Allen was saying, it's pretty important to consider your own person. Not just my safety, but safety of my staff. As a doc, I'm responsible for literally everyone that you need, and as well as the patient. And the patient that you have a friend. How am I going to keep everyone safe? So it is an important thing to consider and use a plan.
And it speaks to, you need a plan. So it really speaks to the need to have protocols in place before you start taking care of trafficking victims. And in all of our healthcare settings, we're taking care of them. We just haven't started noticing them. But really, before you dive in, you need to have a safety plan in place. There's a whole spectrum of safety considerations to think about it and consider as you're developing your protocols. So unfortunately, we're out of time, but...
I think your second question is also really, really important. I think targeting the individuals who are the demand side of things, that are perpetuating the demand for individuals who are exploited, is really important. I don't think that there's much work currently being done with individuals who are exploiting people for domestic or labor trafficking. I might be wrong, and the other panelists might know more about that. I think there is some being done with individuals who are trafficked for sexual exploitation, targeting the individuals who utilize these women purchase sex. And I think that a lot of it is coming out of that domestic violence framework, and I think some of our presenters have referred to that framework has been really important for developing the human trafficking work that's being done, even though we might be 25 years behind. And so a lot of DV work does work with men or with the people who are perpetuating violence, and I do think it's a critical part of it. And I don't know too much about what's going on. I know Siddhar Chikara, who's at Harvard, has written sort of some more pop or publicly available stuff about his research in human trafficking, and he talks a lot about that as a need to stop with a man. You can't work with victims, you can't prosecute traffickers, because there's that whole middle group who's going to keep it going. I think they're saying it's more lucrative than drug trafficking now, because it just has to purchase a person once, and then they're free.
Just very quickly, I know we're out of time, but just one more follow-up on your question, is that in the literature review for the study that I presented for you, we identified a culture of tolerance, and what you're saying here is exactly that, a culture of tolerance. And in one of the reviewer's statements, when you submit a journal or an art or study to be published, it's peer reviewed, and one of the reviewers said, oh, I don't think you need this culture of tolerance, culture of tolerance section. I was like, no, I beg to differ, it's saying, because it's a very big part, like you're saying, the culture of hypermasculinity, of online gaming, that is called Pimp My Ho, is the name of this free online game, popular music, so yes, it is very important, and to specifically target in on the film that you saw, I didn't see that film, but I'd like to see that. I'm not sure if anyone can
education is also a really important part of it, because I think men, I shouldn't say men, individuals who are, for example, purchasing sex, don't necessarily realize what's behind it. The data is very poor. In the UK, though, they estimate that 70% of individuals who are sex workers have been trafficked. And of course, it depends on the definition you use and who you're able to involve in research to look at those numbers. But I think if men knew that there's a 70% chance that every prostitute or escort that they engaged with was somebody who'd been trafficked, I think that would change that culture of tolerance from there.
And on the prevention side of things, on the labor trafficking side of things, there are organizations that are looking at supply chain analysis. California has passed some laws that are trying to address that. There's a lot that's in media recently in terms of the fishing industry in the Mekong region of the world. But there are a lot of great players that are working in the labor trafficking prevention space as well. So unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our panelists.